The following talk was given by Steve Hagen in Minneapolis on July 7, 1997. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good evening. Welcome to the fourth class on Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I want to pick up where we were last week. And we'll get out of the first part tonight, I think. I hope. We were talking about bowing when we left the section on bowing. And we were on page 44. So I'd like to pick it up from there. In the middle of the page, he said, in your big mind, everything has the same value. Everything is Buddha. And here, as I said last week, this reference to Buddha is a reference to reality itself, and not necessarily the historical Buddha. But in your big mind, everything has the same value. He says, in your big mind, but actually big mind isn't your mind. You shouldn't confuse this with your own ego mind. Big mind is just simply mind itself, or reality itself. It is just simply this. But within this experience right now, everything has the same value. Or to one who is awake, everything has the same value. Therefore, to one who is awake, their mind isn't lurching toward this, away from that, favoring one thing over another, trying to bring about this condition as opposed to the next or whatever. This is characteristic of big mind, or mind itself. And one who is awake, in the moment you're awake, your mind will begin to resemble big mind. Another characteristic of it, he says, you see something or hear a sound, and there you have everything just as it is. And this is actually your experience as well, because in fact you are experiencing big mind. Another word we could use for this would be perception. In each moment you're actually experiencing reality. Or this is a big mind. So we hear a sound, we see something, and we have everything just as it is. We have reality itself. The problem is that for most of us, we interpret the sound, we interpret the sight. So immediately we're not with what the actual experience is, but we're reading something into it. We're overlaying the experience with something, some thought, some feeling, some interpretation on the experience. But if you're sitting here in meditation, the point is just simply to be with what is actually taking place in this moment. This is very difficult, and it takes some time before you really begin to realize what just the sound is that you hear, what simply what the thing is that you see. Or simply, it's not even what the thing is, it's just simply what is seen, what the actual sight is, what the actual sound is. In other words, what the actual experience is. But with big mind is just simply that experience itself. Small mind comes in and starts throwing things on top of it. This is your ego mind. This is your mind of preference and your mind of calculation. A normal everyday mind. And it leaves us in a world of picking and choosing. It leaves us in a world of this and that. And we're kind of tossed about by all of this. But also, this isn't a matter of ignoring. Say you're in meditation and you just simply realize the sound that you hear, or the sight that you see, the thought that comes up. It doesn't mean to ignore the actual experience. Because perhaps if what you hear is something, it might mean you have to move or you have to do something. So this isn't about going into some kind of trance or anything of that sort, because the fact of the matter is we always live in two worlds, one superimposed on the other. I just said they're two worlds, but actually, strictly speaking, they're not really two worlds, but it's the world of absolute reality, which is the actual experience that you're having from moment to moment. And then there's the world of relative reality. It's going on at the same time. Ordinarily, we just live in this world of relative reality, and we ignore the actual world that we're in, real reality. So this is not to ignore or to go into absolute reality and then ignore the relative reality, because maybe you need to respond to something. Like, for example, I remember one time I was with a friend of mine out west, and he's a geologist, my friend Bill, and he's fun to travel with out west because he knows all these wild places to go, you know, very exciting places. And one time we were in the Arches National, it was a national monument at that time, I think it's a park now. I don't know if you've ever been there, but just during the off season, we got under the what's called Landscape Arch. It's the longest span of rock in the world, a natural bridge of rock. It's almost a football field in length. It's something like 6 feet short of a football field in length. It's a slab of rock way up in the air, just spanning the sky. It crosses over on a very steep hillside. And so we're up on the side of this hill under this slab of rock. I remember my friend, he's kind of a wild guy. I mean, he'd go into all kinds of crazy places. You know, he was kind of a spelunker, you know, goes into caves and does all kinds of really risky kinds of things, you know. And he would get under this arch and feel very comfortable under it. I was kind of nervous with, you know, tons of rock over my head like this, you know. But he just laid down on a slab of rock, and he was just lying on his back, you know, looking up at this span of red rock overhead, beautiful blue sky, you know. And I was under the rock too, but I wasn't lying down. I was ready to to move, you know. And suddenly we, and like I say, it was the off season. It was just the two of us out there, and there's nothing around. Just dead silent. And all of a sudden, we heard this thundering, loud crack, you know, and just, you know, and my friend, who, you know, he's a meditator too, but he was just lying under there. I remember he just suddenly perked up, you know, he just got like feet and head came up like this, you know, still at his head. He says, "What's that?" You know. And by that time, I was already racing up the hill, and I didn't hear any thundering sound, you know, like I expected, because it really sounded like that thing was coming down. And I looked around, and he was down the hill. Afterward, I thought it was kind of, you know, he should know better. That if you're going to run, you better go up, you know. So my point is that we can't, even in a kind of a meditative state, you're lying there, you should be focused and aware. Everything is the same value. Everything's the same. But suddenly there's this loud sound, and you're under a very delicate span of rock like that. It could come down. It will come down sometime, no doubt. They don't let people up on top of it anymore. So we have to be here. We have to be present with whatever the situation is that we're in. We can't lose sight of that. And so even though we live in a world where in reality everything has the same value, still we live in a world where everything is also different. So this is called difference and unity, and we talk about in Zen. There's a Zen text called The Merging of Difference and Unity, which I'd like to show you sometime in the future. But this is something that we have to realize, that even though we want to come into this world of unity, this world of absolute reality and truth, this is what we want to awaken to see what this is moment to moment, we never really leave this world of difference, because this difference is actually merged with this world of unity. So in other words, we can't go into a trance, we can't go into some kind of you know, sublime state of mind and tune out our environment. Or the fact that everything has the same value doesn't mean that it's all kind of a whitewash and it doesn't really matter whether the rock falls or not. Of course, it doesn't really matter if the rock falls or not. On the other hand, if you're under it, you might want to move. So this is very important. We have to remember where we are. We have to remember the reality, this relative reality that we're in. But it isn't the only reality. There's another aspect or dimension to reality that we have to awaken to. Well, this is the meaning of Big Mind. Everything has the same value. He says, if you do not have this firm conviction of Big Mind in your practice, then he was talking about Bao again. then your bowel will be dualistic. And if you remember last week, we talked about in bowing, this is not bowing, this is not a gesture of reverence to other. This bow is simply to reality itself. And we're not Japanese people, so for us, this bow might be kind of strange. So I don't think we really have to do a lot of this. But the spirit that's behind this, to have this kind of mind where you feel this as you meet others, as you encounter things in your life, this is what's important to remember. And the spirit behind this bow is this great conviction in reality itself. It is a conviction that your experience is genuine, that your experience is true and real, and that this is reality itself. And it is not simply what you think or what you evaluate or what you parse out from reality. Okay, then across the page, I want to say a little bit more. We talked about this 2 weeks ago. I talked about the paramitas, or the four vows of the bodhisattva, and which when I rephrased them, getting rid of the pronoun I, to save all sentient beings, though they are innumerable, to end all desiring, though desires are endless, to learn the Dharma, or the teachings of the awakened, though it is boundless, to attain awakening, though awakening is unattainable. I want to say a little bit more about this. He said at the end, if it's unattainable, then how can we attain it? But we should. He says, yeah, we should awaken to truth and reality. And he said, this is Buddhism. He said, to think that because it's possible, we will do it. He said, this is not Buddhism. This is not what, basically the word for Buddhism is Buddha Dharma, or what the awakened teach. And they don't teach that we do something because it is possible. That doesn't help us at all. Just because something is possible, we should do it. That is not a very good philosophy of life. Just because we can pollute the earth, it doesn't mean we should do it. Just because we can invent a nuclear war, doesn't mean we should get into that. Maybe it doesn't even mean that we should make those bombs, you know, just because we can. So because it is possible, we will do it. This is not a Buddhist teaching. Even though it is impossible, we have to do it because our true nature wants us to. And this is kind of, a couple of weeks ago, Leslie, I guess it was, brought up the question about the bombing in Oklahoma City. But at that time, I guess the question was whether or not Zen was saying, well, if we don't say this is bad, then perhaps the implication was that this is good. Can we say that? Of course not. Zen doesn't say that that is good. But the point is, our typical way of looking at things when we see something like this, say the bombing in Oklahoma City, then we feel like we have to do something. Of course, our thinking is such that we will always try to do that which is possible to do. Like somehow we can bring this difficult episode in our history to some kind of resolution. By what? Going in there and getting the people who did it? And then why did they do it? And where does that come from? And it leads us back into all kinds of... This is an unresolvable situation that we're in. And yet we treat it as if somehow we go in there and we get this guy and we put him to death and then it's over. Because in our hearts we want to resolve this. We want to bring this to some kind of resolution. So we'll do that which is possible to do, and we'll do it in such a way that we'll try to convince ourselves that this is the end of it. But of course it isn't the end of it. Because the situation that we're always in is that it never ends. It just goes on and on and on and on and on. So how do we deal with this situation? This is the thing that is impossible to do, to bring this to some kind of resolution. So how do we deal? This is the muddy water that I've talked about from time to time. How do we deal with this unresolvable situation that we're in? Well, this is what these four vows are all about. And to bring ourselves back here, back to this moment, to see what is going on, to get into this wholesome mind, which is not dividing one thing off from another, setting one thing off from another, and having different factions going at it. Not treating the world in this way. This is the way that we can begin to resolve the conflicts that we have in our hearts toward others, And as they grow and expand into something as enormous as the Oklahoma City incident, this is the way that we can resolve it. And this is to go into that very thing which is impossible to resolve. And we can bring it to some kind of resolution, but the resolution that it will come to will be in your heart, and in my heart, and perhaps in the hearts of others that you can touch by dealing with this unresolvable situation in that way. This is healing. And this is to maintain this vow. And this is our only hope of bringing about a resolution to this kind of pain and sorrow and suffering that we heap upon ourselves. So this is a very important point, difficult to understand, because we're always leaping to that hard crystalline answer, yet this is what we have to do to take care of this situation. But this is delusion, because we can take care of nothing in that way, as though this thing were somehow isolated and cut off from everything else, the Oklahoma City bombing or whatever. You know, everything has tentacles on it. It's reaching back through time and space and affecting all kinds of people in all kinds of various ways. This is the situation we're always in. So now in this impossible situation, how do we deal with it? This is the question that we ask in Buddhism. And the answer is always to come back to this moment and to see what this moment is, and to observe your own leanings of mind and see if whether or not you're lunging toward this or away from that to try to affect some kind of change, as opposed to just seeing the backdrop of the situation we're in and now acting with some kind of sanity and some kind of connection with the actual thing that is taking place around you. On the next page he says, before you determine to do it, whatever it is you're going to do, this impossible thing, before you determine in your heart you're going to do this, he says, you have difficulty. But once you start it, once you start this action, he said, your effort will appease your inmost desire. Once you start it, he says, you won't have difficulty. And your effort will appease your inmost desire. He said, there is no other way to attain calmness. Calmness and centeredness of mind, which is one of the aspects of this practice that we are learning. And he said, calmness of mind, this is a very important point now. It's bringing us right back to what I've been saying. Calmness of mind does not mean that you should stop your activity. So we should remember this, because, you know, as I said, it doesn't help us to crystallize the objective, you know, the thing that we have to do, and then to try to resolve that thinking it is all done. It doesn't then mean that, well, we should do nothing, that we should only sit here on our cushions and make our minds calm. Of course, make your mind calm, get focused, get centered from moment to moment. See if you can do that and maintain that as much as possible through your life, but you cannot spend your life just sitting on a cushion. So he said, calmness of mind doesn't mean that you should stop your activity. Real calmness should be found in activity itself. And we say it is easy to have calmness in inactivity. It is hard to have calmness in activity, but calmness in activity is true calmness. This is when you can have calmness. It's like my teacher used to say about the practice of patience, which is one of the perfections of a bodhisattva. We have to learn to perfect this patience, but you can only do that. You can only perfect patience at this time when you cannot be patient. If you can be patient, well, then you can't practice patience. You can only practice patience when you can't be patient. See, when you're in this impossible situation, you see, now you can do something. You can actually practice patience. When you're in this impossible situation where people are really going at it, now we can begin to practice this action of healing, make this effort toward healing the world. And of course, we're always in this situation. We shouldn't lose sight of this. It's the same thing with enlightenment. We think we want to attain enlightenment so that, I don't know, we can go through life unscathed, you know, by all of the difficulty that we find in the human world. But the fact of the matter is, this awakening is always going on in this realm of delusion. And this is where we find it. We practice patience in a realm where you can't be patient. We practice enlightenment in a realm where we're deluded. Okay? And we practice right effort in a realm where our effort is and our practice is impure, as we looked at a couple weeks ago. So this is a very subtle and difficult practice. And then he ends this section by talking about walking through the mist. When I come to Zen training, Zen practice, like, okay, I'm going to get in here, I'm going to do this, I'm going to learn to meditate, and like we expect, within a week or two, maybe a month, some people I find within one Zen period of Zen expect calmness of mind. Of course, maybe you can find some calmness of mind, but this real calmness, this true calmness, as he's talking about, can only come about through hard practice over a long period of time and through all kinds of difficulties and trials. And here, now, maybe we have a chance to work and establish this calmness of mind, patience, and awakening. And everything else that you want to find, we'll find it here in this muddy water, where we think there isn't any calmness. And this is to acquire the attributes of one who has undertaken this practice, and it is something that is acquired over a long period of time. So we should understand this about this practice. And there's no end to it. So he likens it to walking in the fog. Well, this isn't Suzuki. This is Dogen. This actually goes way back, this teaching. But awakening to this and to acquire this practice and to master this practice is something that goes on over a long period of time. So we should just forget about this end point, this end goal, like awakening or anything of that sort. That's once again just to make some kind of crystalline, hard and fast object there that you're trying to get. Leaves you with a greedy mind. Just forget about all of that, because there isn't any such point anyway. Everything has these tentacles, as I was talking about. You won't find that point. So forget about that. Just come into this moment and find your calmness, find your sanity, your peace of mind in this moment. This is what this practice is all about. We have to learn to remind ourselves of where we are from moment to moment and bring ourselves back to this. This is to walk in the mist, and gradually over time, we discover that we are getting wet with the fog of Zen. Heavy mist, I don't know. Okay, any questions about that? What I've said? Okay, I'll move ahead to page 57, Zen and Excitement. First paragraph down in that section, Zen is not some kind of excitement, but concentration on our usual everyday routine. Now, it's easy to become excited about Zen. You know, but if you get really excited about Zen, I mean, Zen is this really wonderful, deep, profound teaching and practice. But if you become excited about Zen, then you're just throwing yourself into just kind of ordinary realm, where we find a lot of excitement. On the next page, he said, Zen is not something to get excited about. You know? Zen is kind of the opposite of an excited mind, in a way. So he said, some people start to practice Zen just out of curiosity, and then it only makes them busier. And he said, if your practice makes you worse, it's ridiculous. Of course, I should talk. I'm living a very busy life right now. But even in a busy life, the busyness he's talking about is the busyness of mind. And if your mind is just spinning on, you're getting excited, you're chasing about, running after this and that, or screaming about how wonderful this practice is, this is kind of missing the point. He says, do not be too interested in Zen, because you'll make Zen into... I mean, what is this Zen? The Zen is, as I said before, it's just clear water. Nothing to get excited about, nothing to put on other people. It is nothing that should alter you or change you in some particular way. Like you're acquiring some new belief, or you're becoming a zealot of some sort, or you're trying to put something on other people, or you're trying to control things in any way, trying to reshape things in some particular way. No, Zen is just nothing more than coming into this moment. What's so exciting about that? Zen is very boring, you know. You know, you should do it, don't you know? To come into this moment. See, with our deluded mind is just to chase about, to go after this thing or that thing or the next thing, you know. This is excitement. This is, we find it out there. If you bring it into this moment, if you're truly here in this moment, you won't find excitement. You also won't find the boogeyman. You won't find something to be terrified of. If you bring it into this moment, you come into this moment. And strictly speaking, you will not find boredom either. If you have to have some dazzling thing out there that you have to chase after, this is how we spend our lives, well, now you can also become bored easily. You can become frightened easily. You can become greedy easily. But Zen is not about anything of that sort. It's about simply learning to come into this moment. And if you do, then we don't find a boredom, or we don't find something that we have to chase after. We find a rich, full experience right here, ongoing in each moment of our life. And we can find utter, total fulfillment right here, right now, no matter what comes up, no matter what you find. And we can find a richness and a goodness in it. But we can only find that if we come into this moment. You think about something that might terrify you or something that you really don't want to happen. But when is this taking place? Is it ever taking place with you right now? And you know, it's usually taking place. You'll notice this. It's taking place in your mind as you sit here thinking about something. Thinking about something that might happen. Thinking about something that did happen. And of course, all the while, ignoring the fact that you're embellishing it, you're distorting it, you're changing it. Never has to do with this moment. But if you come into this moment where you can actually deal with things, you'll find something rich and true and real and wonderful, and it always tastes delicious. That's what this moment has to offer. And this is the only place where we can find it, is right here, right now. The practice, then, in Zen is not to imagine something wonderful or something out there, but it's just simply to come into this moment. Well, I'm going to jump way ahead because there's something up here I think I really should talk about. This would be page 71. Mistakes in practice. He said there are several poor ways of practice which you should understand. Usually when you practice Zen, you become very idealistic and you set up an ideal or a goal which you strive to attain and fulfill. But as I have often said, this is absurd. So this is the same thing once again. We set that thing up out there. You know, we're chasing after. We have to understand that this is the longing mind. This is the mind of dissatisfaction. You have it now. You know, if it's that thing out there that you have to chase after, this thing out there that you have to get. So if you practice in this way, you're very idealistic, and you set up some kind of goal out there, something that you have to reach. Maybe you think it's something like enlightenment. I guarantee you, if you set enlightenment out there like that as a goal in that way, you will not get there because it will always stay out there. And as you kind of like putting the stick, you know, and you hang the carrot out there, you know, and whether for human beings, that works for a donkey maybe, but for human beings, we put this, particularly if you become a Zen student, you put this stick on out here, and then we hang enlightenment out here like this, and then you keep trying to go for that. But enlightenment just keeps eluding you. You have to realize what enlightenment is and where is it. Do you know where enlightenment is? Anybody know? Come on. It's right here. You're in it. You see? And if you would only notice this actual experience, you will see that. You don't have to go after it. You don't have to chase it. But we set up this ideal goal, and then we strive to attain it. And he said, as I've said, this is absurd. When you are idealistic, you have some gaining idea. Just look at that right there. Notice for a moment, if you're watching your own heart and your own mind, you see this gaining idea right there in your own mind. You're trying to trying to bring about, trying to get. This is not awakening. And you can't get to awakening through this process. This process is just simply what it is. This process of trying to get. It's a greedy mind. It just remains a greedy mind. The awakened mind is just simply to notice when you're doing that. And then when you really notice you're doing that, you can stop. Of course, you'll do it again the next minute. But you have to kind of stop and remind yourself. Come back to this moment. And you realize once again, there I'm doing it again. So we live all our lives this way. Well, actually, most of us never check ourselves at all. We just keep on going, you know. And of course, you get that thing. I guess that's what he talks about here. You get that thing. And even though you've got it now, you're looking for this other thing. Now, you've already forgotten about this thing. Well, that's last year's model or something. You know, you're never satisfied in this way. So this is a big mistake in practice. And there's no end point. There's no end point to anything. Buddhism is a religion about middles. You know, it's never about the end. It's never about the beginning, and it's never about the end. You don't have a beginning or an end. You can't find it anywhere. You can't find the beginning or end of anything. Not yourself. You don't know. You can't find where you began. You can't pin that down. And you don't find any end either. All we ever find is this. It's just always... And this is where reality is. It's always right here, right now. But we're somewhere else most of the time, in our mind. It's chasing about... Zen is about nothing more than coming back into this moment and seeing it for what it is. And now you can really deal with it. If you do have a problem, if you're really in this moment, it's not really a problem because you can handle it. If you're in this moment, you can deal with it. What's your problem? But if you project it out there, well, now it's a problem and you can't solve it. You will never resolve it. That's what we talked about earlier. And then you will always look for that thing to finally put an end to it. But, of course, it doesn't put an end to anything. It's our old habit. We do it again and again and again. This is delusion. This is confusion. This is pain and suffering. The only way out of this is to learn again and again the subtleties of it, but just coming back into this moment. And taking on this practice of meditation and learning to see this moment for what it is. So he said, if you're chasing about in this way, he says, you'll be sacrificing the meat of your practice because your attainment is always ahead. Okay, it's always off in the future. And of course, the future is never here. The future is always the future. So it never comes, you know. And he said, you will always be sacrificing yourself now for some ideal in the future. And this is how we spend our lives. And especially when we're younger, we get older. Finally, we don't have too much off in the future anymore that we keep dreaming about, but now we spend our time thinking about the past. Things you'd like to get back to, maybe dreadful experiences that you just soon forget about, but they keep coming back and haunting you. All the while, most of us tend to ignore this moment, which is reality. If we only come into it and see this moment for what this is, awakening, right there. And nothing you have to strive for. You don't have to strive for coming into this moment because where do you think you are? All the striving you do gets you out of this moment. It never brings you into this moment. You're in this moment. That's why we call it waking up. Just wake up to where you are, you see. So we have to understand this before we take enlightenment or the goal of Zen practice and putting it out there somewhere. We have to really get it down as to what this practice is. But you go off chasing off in the future, he says you'll end up with nothing. He said this is absurd. It is not adequate practice at all. But even worse than this idealistic attitude is to practice as in competition with someone else. This is a poor, shabby kind of practice. And it certainly is, because once again, here you are, you've projected yourself out of yourself. You're looking around. You're looking at what someone else is doing, or how am I doing? Oh, I'm better than this guy, or I'm not as good as that, or whatever. It is nothing more than to come out of this moment. This is just simple business as usual, the way we normally operate in virtually every aspect of our life. We have to come to realize what this practice is. And it is simply, it's not even to not do that. It is to notice when you're doing that. And then you will stop. Because that is the only way we can do it. You cannot force yourself to stop acting in this greedy way that we normally act. A little further down, when you are tired of sitting or When you are disgusted with your practice, you should recognize this is a warning signal. You become discouraged with your practice when your practice has been idealistic. You have some gaining idea in your practice and it is not pure. It is when your practice is rather greedy that you become discouraged with it. So that's the sign. Your practice becomes greedy. You have some agenda. You have something that you're trying to do. Once again, in a Zen text called the Song of Jewel Mirror Awareness, it ends with the lines that to enter into this practice is just to sit like a fool, outwardly like a fool, like an idiot. This is to sit with no agenda, but to sit like a fool, like an idiot. And then it says, the last line is that this is the host within the host. And this is what we have to learn to become, as the host within the host. For most of us, we're a host for the guest. And the guest here means, well, that thing that you're after, the stuff of your thoughts, you know, the conceptual world that you project out there, that's the guest. It is something foreign. It is something removed from you. And we live out our lives trying to be this host for the guest, always trying to please that thing out there, or trying to get that thing out there, or merge with that thing out there, or cater to that thing out there in some way. And we're never a host for the host. But this is another word for enlightenment, that the thing we have to take care of is right here with us right now. If we can learn to be the host for the host, this is to be free of that greedy mind, always looking out there, that thing out there. This is to come to realize that everything is already within yourself right now. Suzuki Roshi would call this big self. So you might think, well, if I don't take care of that stuff out there, I'll be neglecting my guests. But you see, actually, from the enlightened point of view, there aren't any guests. You are the host of reality itself. This is what you have to take care of. If you take care of reality in this moment, you will discover that you're taking care of everybody else as well. You'll be doing the best thing you can do for them. The Oklahoma City bombing, and how to take care of that, and how to comfort the people who are suffering through that incident, how to cure your own mind of anger and action that might lead you, well, not that you would do anything as extreme as the Oklahoma City thing, but surely people get into these kinds of situations. It is always because we act as the host for the guest. But in reality, if you look very carefully at your experience, there is never any guest. You are never removed from anything that you are experiencing. And if you are experiencing it, if you notice very carefully what that experience is, you are already intimately close with it. There's no separation at all. This is to be the host for the host. So this is not only the best way to take care of yourself, but this is also the best way to take care of the guest. Best way to take care of the, quote, guest, unquote, is to realize that you have no guest. There's just simply this reality right now. I am not speaking of your ego self at this point, of course, to your separate ego, and this is where we normally are, locked up in our own mind. And we think, yes, there's a guest, of course. I understand that, and that's fine. And please, take care of people. But when you take care of people, take care of them as yourself. Christ said, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. How are you going to do that? The only way you can do that is to realize that, well, what do you think you are? This is yourself. And if you take care of the world around you in that way, as if this were you, there's no separation between you. There's only the host here. Then you will be living in a way that will cure the world and all the kinds of difficulties and pains that we inflict upon ourselves. This is to be the host within the host. And this is to practice like an idiot, like a fool. Outwardly, you look like a fool, like an idiot, because you don't seem to have any agenda. This is a Zen master. They practice in this way. They don't seem to be about anything. All they're about is just trying to stay in this moment and to help the rest of us come into this moment. And now if you can come into this moment, sure, you're not a Zen master, you got another kind of job, but now you can do that job, you see. And you don't have to alienate others, you don't have to cause frictions and difficulties and pain, confusion in your life. So then at the top of page 73, I'll skip that part where he talks about most Buddhist priests have a difficult time with their teachers. There's some truth to that. But he said, you may think that without hardship, I'm kind of editing here a little bit, without hardship you cannot practice Zen. But this is not true. This is another kind of phenomena that goes on with certain people. Not everybody falls into this trap, but it might be worth mentioning. You get into this Zen practice, and in many ways it seems to be difficult. So then we get the idea that this practice has to be difficult, that if it weren't difficult, then maybe it isn't working, or maybe it isn't doing something for me, you know, something of that sort. This is something you should kind of watch for. This practice really shouldn't be difficult at all. And in fact, I think he says down here a little further toward the bottom, he says, if you find some difficulty in your practice, that's a warning that you might have some wrong idea there. As we said at the very beginning, you know, it's not difficult because it's hard to get into this posture. Okay, if you have a difficult time getting into this posture, etc., fine. That's all quite understandable. Make yourself as comfortable as you can. You know, you can deal with that. What is difficult, he said, in this practice is making your mind pure. But this kind of difficulty is not the difficulty of straining and struggling and striving, this sort of thing. This is actually how we make our mind impure. Because this kind of straining and struggle and striving, as we've just been looking at, is to operate with this idea that there's something out there that you have to get. So the difficulty is just simply, it doesn't require any kind of straining, but it does require a certain amount of mindfulness and remembering what this assignment is here in this kind of practice, and that is just simply to come back into this moment. This is what's kind of difficult about it. But it isn't a kind of difficulty where you have to go out there and struggle and strain to do this. You don't have to whip yourself. Oh, I thought I saw a hand there. I'm desperately waiting for a hand. Somebody asked me a question. Yeah.
Steve, as far as defining what exactly is being in this moment, I noticed in your book you made an observation about observation of the truth, that you either see it entirely or it eludes you completely.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true about observation of the moment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can't be partially in this moment. You're either in this moment or you're not. Yeah, same thing's true there. Mm-hmm. So when people say, and we've all said this, you know, like, I think I'm getting what you're saying. I kind of, you know. And, well, this is, what you're getting there, I mean, you are. Yeah, you're getting something there, but what you're getting is an idea. You're just kind of, you're right on the edges of grasping that idea. Because when you actually see, there's nothing there to get. You really, you know, there's no real knowing here. A Buddha, strictly speaking, if you deal with what the Buddha knows in enlightenment, the Buddha doesn't really know anything in the way that we commonly think of knowing. Of course, this happens to be actual true knowing. But the fact of the matter is you have this knowledge now. Is another word for it is perception, or the immediate experience of this moment before you begin to distort it and put it into a conceptual form. And now when you're getting to this stage where you're putting it in a conceptual form, this is the stage where we have things like, oh, I'm kind of getting it into a concept here. But that's not what this is about. Now, which isn't to say that that's bad. You are going to put it in a conceptual form. And that's fine. It's natural. It's good. But the actual seeing of what this is not something you can actually grasp. Okay, and that's true awakening there. And it is something that you're actually experiencing now. The basic problem that we have is that we ignore what the experience is. And we call this ignorance. And this is the basic problem that we have as human beings.
Could you say something about the last part of that paragraph, top paragraph on page 73.
About Dogen Zenji's comment?
Yeah.
That do not think that you will necessarily be aware of your own enlightenment. Yeah, right, don't think that. I don't know, what do you want to know?
Well, if you see, are you going to be aware of it or not?
In the actual moment of seeing, you're not, strictly speaking, you're not there. All it is this normal sense of self that we have, that we're walking around with. And of course, most of the time, a good portion of the time, we've kind of forgotten about it. It's pretty vague. But as soon as anything happens, it just shows up. Oh, I saw, or I heard, or I think. But in actual awakening, there's no, oh, I saw, or I heard, or I think. That doesn't go on. You can't really speak of it that way. And when you begin to speak of it that way, well, of course, you're right back in delusion again. And this is usually what happens if you wake up. There's no you there having this experience. The experience is, this is it. And all you fall back into your ordinary mind, and now, oh, I had this awakening. But of course, the awakening you're speaking of now is just your ordinary delusion. You know, so it isn't like the light bulb going on when you finally get an idea. You know, you've been struggling with this problem or whatever, and you haven't been able to work it out. What's the solution? And then finally you get it. And you say, oh, I see. But awakening isn't quite like that. There's no, oh, I see. If there's an, oh, I see, well, this is just ordinary seeing. It's just you see another idea, just another thought. See? So that's what he's saying, is, you know, don't think that you're necessarily aware of your own awareness. Now, later on, when you're back in your ordinary mind, you will realize what that is. Somebody once likened this awakening to catching a bus. You know, you go out here on Grand, I imagine, buses are always going by, right? The bus of enlightenment. And they go by, you know, and maybe you can catch one. You know, but it's kind of like that. But the enlightenment is, it's always going on. And when you're on the bus, you don't think anything of it. But when you get off the bus, or if you miss the bus, then it shows up. You know, and there's some disturbance in your mind, you know. But this is just ordinary, confused mind. If you get hit by a bus, won't hurt. I don't know. I don't know how far we can go with this analogy. It's not my analogy. I'm sorry I borrowed it. Yeah, Libby.
On the quote from Dogen Zenji, would it be legitimate to flip it to say that once you are enlightened, awareness is no longer an issue?
Well, there isn't any once you are enlightened, because
if you were to be in a light, no.
State of enlightenment is awareness.
But I mean awareness of being there.
There isn't any awareness of being there. Yeah. Because if there's awareness of being there, that's conceptual awareness, you know, which is not awakening.
So we're saying intuition?
It's very much like intuition, but it's not intuition. It differs from intuition in one aspect. Intuition has just one more thing that awakening doesn't have, and that is intuition has an object. You have some intuition about something. Some thought, some feeling, some idea, some whatever. There's an object there. And awakening is basically the same thing, but no object. What is your intuition about? Well, you know. But even to talk like this is kind of nonsense in a way, and it's not really very helpful for us. I'm kind of sorry he even brought it up. You brought it up. I wasn't going to talk about this. So actually, you know, it's best not to say too much about awakening, because once again, all we do is just sit here getting ideas about things, and it's up there, and pretty soon we're kind of getting this greedy mind. The enlightenment, you have the enlightened mind now. You understand. You are having an actual, real, true experience now. Question is, what is it? What's the true experience here? What's the real, because it's going on. So it's just a matter of paying real close attention to what's actually happening. Not what you think is happening, not what you explain to yourself is happening, but what's actually happening. And if you actually can see what's really happening, this is freedom in there. There's liberation in that. That's another word for it. It's liberation. Freedom of mind. And then, of course, you're right back in this deluded world. Here you are. But if you know how it is, you can spare yourself. It's easier to remind yourself of what's really going on, so you don't get too far down the road of delusion again. Yeah, Mary.
I really enjoy being mindful.
Oh, yes.
This is one of the main reasons I make much better choices.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
My actions.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we can do. That's why mindfulness and the practice of mindfulness is pretty important for us. And in the kind of discipline of mind, this we develop through the meditation, the concentration, and the discipline of mind to bring us back to this moment, to stop forgetting, drifting off and coming back to this moment. We can cultivate that and develop that in meditation. And if we learn to just stay here, we'll finally see what's going on. But we're very prone to drift off, you see. But yeah, that's a very good practice that we have to. We can deliberately, intentionally set ourselves in a state of mind where we're just to be mindful of the simple little activities that you're doing. But not just outwardly, but also very important, your own cast of mind, your own leaning of mind. Just to observe that happening. Not to try to control it, not to try to stop those spinning dialogues going on in your mind, but just to notice that it's going on. That's what's required. People think, oh, I got to stop that. You know, but you can't stop that. It just goes on. But if you get better at watching it, it'll stop of its own. But if you never pay attention, it just goes on and on, and you're listening to it. And you'll make up all kinds of stories for yourself. And then you'll be acting out of these stories. But what do they have to do with reality? You know, nothing. And of course, we get deeper and deeper into pain and confusion. How do we get out? Well, the only way to get out is just to start noticing what's going on. And when you start to notice, you get better and you can cultivate this. You can develop this skill of coming back to this moment. And when you do, this is the road back to sanity. So, yeah, that's what this is about. Marjorie, I think you had something?
I can formulate a question. If being present in every moment, we start to see, you know, to see in any given moment, mm-hmm. then there can be any number of things occurring simultaneously in that moment, which we may or may not be aware of. I guess there's two things. One is sort of like the person who's had a lot of practice may be more in tune if you have more practice to certain things than others. That's what I'm wondering about, the layered thing. Also, in terms of kind of a layered...
I'm not sure if I know what you mean by layered.
Let's say it's an evolutionary thing. Let's say that a six-year-old, if they're brought up to think this way, to be in the present moment, just as an evolutionary thing, with not only in terms of the human beings, but in terms of our lifespan, if we are evolving as human beings, then there are certain things that that person at age 25 or 55 or 75 may be aware of that the six-year-old wouldn't.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So then it's acknowledging that there is a layered approach.
Well, we accumulate knowledge and experience. The older we live, the more experience, the more education, you might say, that we've gained in life, because we're learning every day. And so we acquire more and more knowledge in that way. This is actually kind of a long question that maybe we could deal with outside of class. But let me say this about it. Earlier you had said something about trying to keep track of everything because there's too many things going on in a moment or something.
Not
like
that. Mean, but just that there's any number of things going on.
Yes.
We're not always going to be aware of it.
No, but that's not what's involved here. You can't be aware of everything, as all the details, but you understand these details are all going on in the realm of delusion. That is the world. That's the world divided up and split up. And you'll never pin that down because we don't even know where the boundaries are. I mean, we arbitrarily assign them here and there, but where do we end? Do we really end at our skin? Do we end at our birth? I mean, where does it begin and end? And our mind and our thought isn't just connected with others. So if we can't acquire knowledge of every little detail, and that's not what this is about in terms of awareness. The fact of the matter is that to the awakened, the experience is singular. There is this whole thing happening here at once. It's this moment now at once. And it is all happening at once. What you're calling a multitude of things happening is what's happening after your mind gets in there and chops it all up and divides it into, you know, after consciousness has operated and worked. And that's just simply to divide this all up. And now we think the assignment is to unify and keep track of all these things, but the fact of the matter is they're unified to begin with. It's just this moment, and it's of a single whole. This is the thing that when you wake up, you realize, this is a single piece. You see, and it isn't all this different kind of stuff. And this is the merging of difference and unity. We'll have to talk about this in a much later course. But there is this kind of dual aspect that's going on. That the reality that we live in is both unified and singular and multiple. And it all has to do with the functioning of mind and consciousness. But that takes us way outside the range of this course. So I'm not going to say any more about it right now. Miles, you had a question.
Yeah, I am with you. You talked through it, which makes me think again about the nature of delusion.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I had in mind was, is delusion a thing that we do, and if we stop doing this thing, then we're awake?
No. You go ahead and do it anyway. Because you can only be awake when there's delusion. That only goes on in the realm of delusion. So we're always thinking of enlightenment as or awakening as somehow at odds with delusion. No, it's merged with, married to, interidentical with delusion. Yeah. This is why it's so on. It's because we're deluded beings that we can experience enlightenment. If we weren't deluded, we wouldn't even be here. There'd be nothing going on. But look at this. There's clearly the most certain thing there is something's going on here. The question is, what is it? We always misread it. And then that's delusion. We buy into that, you see. But what's really going on here? It's of a single piece. We don't see it that way. And we always see it divided up. Is it divided up or not? Well, again, that's that part that I kind of, you know, I got to take into that gradually over. I got some other things I have to introduce to you or help you along with. But this is the actual experience, both unified and singular at once. Merging of difference and unity. This is the actual experience that we have from moment to moment. We buy into our normal experience, the normal state of delusion that we're in, is that we buy into totally this realm of division, multiplicity, the world of this and that. And of course now, because we fall in love with or we hate the different kinds of things that show up, we get tossed about. And all the while we think, well, this is reality. It's the full take on reality. No, there's this other aspect of reality where it's all of a piece. And we're missing that entirely. That's the actual experience that we're having. And some people taste this one and then they think, whoa. And I think this is enlightenment. Oh, man. All is one. And I think this is enlightenment. No, that's not enlightenment. That's just as much delusion as all is many. But it's kind of a necessary step to have that. But a lot of people, you know, not too many people actually have that. But fewer still actually wake up beyond that. But you have this experience of all is one, you can really taste it, and it's very profound. And it seems very wonderful, and it's kind of peaceful in a way, and it's kind of, you know. So people really mistake that for awakening, but actually that's still delusion. Obviously, because look, there's all these different things here. How can you say all is one? I'm here, you're there. I mean, what do you mean, all is one? Obvious, the most obvious thing is that there's all this different stuff going on. So how can we say all is one? But then the moment we get lost in this, all this different stuff, which is our normal mind, that doesn't work either. Wait a minute. Everything seems to be kind of connected. I do this and this is happening, you know. That's why that Oklahoma thing, we can't we can't even deal with it as if it were an isolated thing. Well, we've solved that one. No, it's reaching on through people's lives and minds and back through history and all of it, you know. Well, wait a minute. So then is it multiple or not? And if you actually see what it is, this is what we call enlightenment. This is awakening. Suzuki here earlier, he said, not one, not two. You know, not, it's not one, not two. But enough of this. There's another course I teach on this, actually, but I'll teach it then. We've gone far enough with this. All right, maybe that's all I'm going to... But this is kind of an interesting point here. He says, at the bottom of the page, I said, even in wrong practice, when you realize it and continue, there is right practice. This is very important, actually. I should say something about this. So even in wrong practice, if you, how do you put it, when you realize this and you continue, this is right practice. Why? Well, can you answer that? If you're doing something wrong, and now you realize it, but you continue, you're mindful, you're aware of the fact that you don't know. So it's like we don't have a lot of rules and different kinds of things here, but you know, if I had a more formal setup for us, you know, say a meditation hall or whatever, there'd be different kinds of regulations I'll tell you. Just simple little rules, but basically how to enter the room, you know, how to turn and sit down, etc., and then get into the meditation, etc., and then how to leave. All very important, because as you begin your meditation even before you enter the room. So it's very important that we assign something for you to focus your mind on, so you're aware of what you're doing. You know what foot you're using as you enter the room, etc. Already the meditation has begun. You're aware. You're focused on all these different things, you see. When I teach this to students, right away I see these kind of panic looks like, oh, I won't remember all, you know, what foot, and you know, and they get kind of worried. But you see, this goes on in the world of multiplicity, the world of this and that, the world of delusion. And then we think, oh, these are rules. I better follow this. I got to know the right way to do it. Then we start making up things like, well, the right way, of course, it's better because it's the right way, and that's what he told me to do, etc. And we start piling on things and values and emotions, and everything's getting piled up in this. And now we have kind of a, it might seem like, because you're not used to it yet, a complicated procedure, even though it wouldn't be very complicated, but. So you enter the room and now you're panicking. Like, oh, I don't know what foot to use. I don't know how to turn. I don't know how to do this. And then your mind starts shutting down. Well, what's happening? This is the opposite of what you're supposed to be doing. If you're in meditation, you're aware of what's going on. If you don't know what the rule is, why don't you just be aware of that? And then I'll enter the room with full awareness that I don't know what I'm doing. But if you're doing that, you know, you're doing it, you see? This is the part to remember. So he said, you know, when you realize it, and now you continue, this is the point. So the wrong practice, if you're doing something wrong in your practice, if you realize it, that this is wrong, but you know what you're doing, and now you can't say that this is wrong, because that's the point of this practice. Right practice is simply to be here and know what you're doing. If we had a formal structure like that, gradually, you pick it up, learn it. Of course, I've seen, you know, some people will rebel. Well, I'm not going to do that just because you tell me, or just because everybody else is doing it. I'm not going to do that. Fine, I don't care, but look at your state of mind when you're acting that way. You know, it doesn't bother me. I'm watching my own mind. That's your business. But the whole point of this is, you know, you think I'm going to be shackled by the fact that you don't want to do this? No, but why don't you look at your state of mind right now? See? And you're shackling yourself. And of course, to do it this way or that way, does it really matter? No, but what does matter and what this practice is about is to know what you're doing, to be aware of it, and to notice this leaning of mind, to notice when you're acting out of some kind of rebellion or some kind of, you know, where's it getting you? You know, it's just, once again, just acting out of, you know, there's something out there apart from me, and boy, I'm going to control it. I'm going to push it away. I'm going to take it if I want it, you know, and that, you know. Oh, that's our greedy, leaning mind again. And it gets us in a lot of trouble. Causes a lot of pain, a lot of confusion, a lot of difficulty. Okay, but you learn to do this. And he said, this is the secret of practice. Of course, he's said this frequently throughout the book. There's a lot of secrets of practice, I guess. I don't know. Okay. He said, the cause of conflict, this is on page 74, the cause of conflict, one paragraph down, the cause of conflict is some fixed idea or one-sided idea. When everyone knows the value of pure practice, we will have little conflict in our world. That is really true. When everyone knows. Of course, that's not your business. You can't get everybody to know. But how about you? When you know this, now you don't. You shouldn't have to enter into a lot of conflict and difficulty. It's just fixing on some one-sided idea. Not one-sided idea meaning that you're not looking at the whole fabric. As I said before, with enlightenment awakening, you're seeing this whole fabric, not as having a grip on all the different aspects of this field of multiplicity. You know, because, yeah, you think, how can I possibly get all that in mind? Well, no, you can't. But if you notice how the experience is actually being experienced, it's an experience of a whole piece, you see? And if you're mindful of this, now you're not acting out of this one-sided thing or that side over here. This is what sets up conflict and difficulty. And if you yourself are not coming out of this kind of splintered mind, then you can do a lot to help reduce conflict. But of course, if we all knew the value of this, he calls it pure practice here, we will have little conflict in the world. At the bottom of the page, he said, knowing both the advantages and disadvantages of some special practice, you can practice in that special way without danger. But if you have a one-sided attitude, you will ignore the disadvantage of the practice and emphasizing only the good part. So, this is a problem too. We take on some particular practice or teaching or whatever, and then we kind of identify with it, and then we say, oh, this is good. And pretty soon we're ignoring, oh, there's some things about it that aren't working very well. And we tend to ignore that. We get locked into some kind of one-sided idea here. This is also identity. We take on a particular kind of identity. Oh, I'm this kind of person, or I'm a Zen guy, or something like this. And, you know, of course, immediately we're in opposition to all the non-Zen guys out there. And they might not like it, you know. And
correctly in opposition to the Zen guys.
Even opposite, yeah, that's right. Then you got good Zen guys and bad Zen guys. There's no end to this, you know. Well, study yourself. Page 76. He said, the purpose of studying Buddhism is not to study Buddhism. Now, what do you think about that?
Irritating.
Yeah, we get irritated with these Zen guys because they're always making statements like that, you know. But it's to study ourselves. First of all, Buddhism. What is Buddhism? I mentioned this earlier. I don't really like the term Buddhism. In the book, I have a book coming out in a couple months. It's called Buddhism Plain and Simple. Recommend it. Should be out in October or so. Anyway, but the Buddhism's in the title. But I don't like the word Buddhism, but I had to use it because everybody knows what Buddhism, or at least we think we know. Because the real word is Buddha Dharma. But if I put Buddha Dharma plain and simple, people say, well, what's this, you know? So I put Buddhism, well, my publisher, you know. Well, actually, we went through, maybe you've noticed on my posters, the title kept changing. We had a hard time settling on a title. But the real word is Buddha Dharma. And Buddha Dharma means the teaching of the awakened. The Buddha is awakened, a being, and Dharma is, in this particular case, means a teaching. It also means reality or truth. But he says here, the purpose of studying this, the teaching of the awakened, is not to study the teaching of the awakened. I mean, the Buddha himself likened his teaching to a raft, right? You know this, I think most of us here. but that his teaching is a raft. Normally, with some kind of teaching, we think that the teaching, this teaching is holy, wonderful. You know, this is the most important point. And so then we kind of grab onto this teaching, thinking that this is what it's all about. Well, the Buddha said right up front, this is my teaching is like a raft. You can use it. It'll get you across from this shore of delusion to the shore of awakening. That was the analogy. And then once you get there, he said, what, you want to lug this raft around with you? You don't need it. Just leave it there by the shore. Maybe somebody else can use it. You know. So that's what this teaching is about. So this teaching is not about studying this teaching. The purpose of studying Buddhism is not to study Buddha. It's not for the sake of this teaching. It's to study ourselves. But to study ourselves, this is not like some kind of self-help kind of study. I will study myself to figure myself out so that I can make self-improvement. That's not what this is about. You won't improve that self. You know, it's about forgetting the self. In this particular case, the teaching of the awakened is about learning to forget yourself, learning to realize that you can't pin down what you are, learning to realize that this stuff that you keep putting up about yourself, that you identify with this and you say, I'm this and I'm that, that this is the root of suffering and pain and confusion. So this is about seeing that. So this is a study of ourselves in this way. So to study ourselves is to forget ourself. And this another little angle on this word study ourselves is that to truly study yourself means to study this moment, to study what's going on in this moment. And now you'll realize that you can't find any self in this moment. And with this comes liberation. So this is not about, you should understand in Buddhism, this is not about self, kind of a self-help course. Make self-improvements, you know. Yeah, you improve yourself out of the picture, and now you're free. Of course, you're not anything in particular, but you aren't even now. You just, even though you got an idea, kind of holding yourself together in some fashion or another, and you keep modifying, you keep trying to improve that and stuff. But actually, this is our delusion, you know. And if you realize what's illusory about all of this, then you won't get caught by it, and you can live with a lot more freedom. Well, I see it's 9:00. Oh, I had an interesting little story I was going to tell you. Well, maybe next week. That's a hook, isn't it, to bring you back next week? Well, no, I think it is 9:00, so I think I'll end here. But anyway, thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.